You're listening to Panel Borders, which is an extended podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and continuing Indie Comics Month on the show, I'm talking to self-published author David Bailey about his comics, his 3D graphic novel with Daniel Merlin Goodbury that is being displayed on the walls of a children's hospital in France, and his many attempts to break into the industry. First, though, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. Resonance FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to writer and artist David Bailey. We have in front of us your hardback graphic novel, Tongue of the Dead. It's a homage to 80s Conan the Barbarian comics by Barry Windsor-Smith, amongst others. There's a bit of a touch of recent comedy zombies in there as well. I mean, what would you say your influences were?
Well, I don't think Barry Windsor-Smith, because I haven't read any. What happened was, I was really into Conan comics when I was at school. Ernie Chan, John Buscema, Roy Thomas was writing them, and they were really difficult to get hold of in Scotland. But I picked them up, and when I did get hold of them, they were fantastic. When I was doing mini-comics, because I did this a couple of years ago now, but I was doing mini-comics to hand out to editors at conventions, and I'd done a dirty comedy, I'd done autobiography, I'd done some science fiction. I thought, well, what can I do next? I thought, I'll have a crack at doing a barbarian comic. And at the time, I was also thinking, Dark Horse had just started doing the Conan comic. I thought, well, I can, you know, as soon as I've done the minis, I can send it to them, and you know, within 6 months, I'll be writing Conan. I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm not. But yeah, so I started doing the mini-comics, and I had a really great time, because it was a sort of reliving memories of reading these comics, and I deliberately didn't read, you know, the new Dark Horse Conan comic, and I didn't go back and read the old Conan stuff. I don't know if you're the same yourself, but sometimes you get memories of comics, and the memories are far more fun than the comics themselves. But now I've gone back and reread them, the comics themselves are absolutely fantastic, really well written, really well drawn, a lot better than Tongue of the Dead, but that shouldn't stop anyone finding it and buying it. But in terms of artwork, it's actually more, I was really into, at the time, Eduardo Risso. Because one of the reasons I started to draw was I've always wanted to be a writer. Bear with me, this will make sense at some point. I always wanted to be a writer, but it's fairly obvious that, you know, people are reluctant to read scripts at conventions. And I thought, well, if you draw your own stuff, even if it's bad, people will be able to read the story and tell if you get any sort of storytelling chops. And this was, you know, this was sort of the culmination of that. I thought at this point I could actually draw a comic that makes a bit of sense, it'll look quite nice. But about halfway through, I lost. Not lost confidence, but maybe lost confidence in the style I was using, and started to not steal influence, but things like there was a character with long flowing robes, and I had no idea how to draw long flowing robes, and I was reading 100 Bullets at the time, and Eduardo Risso just has this fantastic way of drawing, you know, the crinkle patterns in clothes. He's got a fantastic way of drawing caricature faces that look more real than a Neil Adams drawing. So I got really into him and started adopting tricks that he adopted. And without, I think without him as an artistic influence, the book would actually be unreadable.
Okay. I mean, would you say that European comics in general were as much an influence on you than American ones?
Culturally, I led quite a sheltered existence growing up in Scotland, because it was very difficult to get hold of anything until I made it to university. I grew up on, you know, I had access to the Beano and the Dandy. I had access to Marvel reprint comics, which at the time were Stan Lee and Jack Kirby stuff, which is fantastic stuff to grow up on. Then it was the Transformers comic, Simon Furman, Jeff Senior, Andy Wildman, guys like that, Dan Reed. Those were my influences when I was forming an idea of what a comic was about. And it was only when I got to university, and then when I came down to London, that I found out that the world of comics was far more rich than that. But in terms of European comics, I'm still a little bit naive.
So in a way, I mean, you know, you talk about Eduardo Risso being an influence on this book. Do you see your style changing from year to year, depending what you've been reading recently and what genre you're attempting? You sort of look at the cultural landscape around you and you think, actually, this is the kind of style I want to have a go at, just in some sort of respects, just to kind of push yourself as an artist.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I mean, about halfway through Tongue of the Dead, because it originally came out as 3 mini comics, and it took a while to get out the door because I was working on other stuff as well. I actually started to get work as a professional illustrator. And I found that really affected how the second half of the book came out. And as a result, the second half of the book just looks a lot better. But yeah, every new project, I try and do something a bit different, try and push myself. I'm working on something just now in Paris. I'm working with you, Daniel Merrigan Goodbury.
Mm-hmm.
Of course you do. He writes Iron Man 2020. Now everyone knows Daniel Merrigan Goodbury.
I bumped into him at the opening of Orbital a couple of weeks ago, and he said, "You know what I'm writing at the moment?"
Do you know where he slept that night?
Yeah.
On my couch.
Nice.
Yeah.
The glamorous world of UK comics, folks.
Yeah, we're all living in old Eddie Campbell back issues. What was I saying?
the current project you're working on with Daniel in France.
It's actually a very cool thing. It's a project being organised, being coordinated by an Italian architect who's been commissioned to come up with something interesting to put in a children's hospital in Paris.
Okay.
Or actually, it's a hospital for teenagers called Casita House. And what they wanted was, they wanted a web comic in the real world. So they wanted a comic whereby it's a three-dimensional comic.
Mm.
So it unfolds as you walk through the building.
Okay.
So there might be a panel by the toilet. There might be a panel on the way in, there might be a panel on the stairs as you go up the stairs. A narrative should form in the mind of the reader as they're walking around the building.
What, based partially also on the surroundings that the panel has in the real world?
Yeah, well...
That actually does sound like a Daniel Merlin Goodbury comic.
Yeah. That's probably why they asked them to do the job.
Because funnily enough, I was in Whip Cross Hospital in Walthamstow on Saturday, and as I was going down the very, very long corridor that that leads from the front door to the ward that my friend was in, I was told as I was getting there, you need to turn left at junction 12, and I'm like, well, is this the M4 or something? As I was walking down that corridor, I noticed actually that they've got an exhibition of cartoons on the walls halfway down this corridor. And it's some British Society of Cartoonists have donated a display there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, you know, there's this old chestnut of finding comics in the sort of like the kids' area of waiting rooms in hospitals. But I think, you know, that's almost become the cultural home of secondhand comics in a way. You know, if you want to find comics anywhere, it'll be in the kids' room in a hospital, you know.
Well, it's a thing, isn't it? A lot of comics creators give all their comic copies to children's hospitals. This children's hospital, like most, has a pile of comics. And being in Paris, it's got a pile of great comics. But I think what they wanted was, in France, 2% of all building projects, 2% of all budgets dedicated to new building projects in France has to be spent on art. And they, especially in hospitals, they think this is a very important thing, not for therapeutic reasons, but just to brighten up the place and give it a cohesive character, a familiarity regardless. You know, you could see one doctor one day and one doctor the next, but they want it to feel like you're always somewhere that you recognise, somewhere. There was a term they used. We had this meeting in Paris, well, we had a number now, but they were speaking in French, so there was a translator. But there was this phrase that kept popping up, transitional objects. Because the panels that are going to be in the hospital are attached by Velcro, because they're the large panels, sort of a metre by a metre and a half. But they're going to move around the hospital.
Okay.
So every time a patient comes in, he'll recognise, you know, this maybe a setting or a character, because they've got recurring characters.
Mm.
But the narrative will form purely in the head of the reader, and it should make a modicum of sense. And there's supposed to be these transitional objects. So as he moves through the hospital, or he or she moves through the hospital, there's a story that's happening. It's a generative story, so it's not a story that we've sat down and written ourselves. It's something that's almost being written by the observer. It's an interesting idea, and I really hope it works.
It sounds fascinating. I mean, I think that there could be a lot more done between the relationship between the landscape and you know, sequential art. There was a very interesting book that came out a few years ago where they'd taken a large format A to Z of London and printed a comic strip in sort of balloons on the page, and you could read it east to west or north to south, northeast to southwest. And obviously, if it was east to west, you'd just turn the panel, the pages. But if it was north to south, you'd have to keep skipping forward six pages to read the next bit. And then where the two stories intersected, there'd be a little crossover of the characters. So,
wow,
you know.
Oh, that sounds cool. Have you seen the Jason Shiga comic? It's a mini comic, but it's online. And it's a pastiche of Choose Your Own Adventure.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen it. So it looks like it, you open it, and it looks like a normal comic book. But the line of narrative changes. So you read left to right, then up, and then you go right or left or down. And when it reaches the end of the page, you get options. So like to go north, turn to page 12. Oh, it might be. Jason Shiga is the guy who did, I might not even be pronouncing his name correctly, but he's the guy who did Book Hunter. It's an action adventure set in a library. It's Book Hunter is the librarian. He goes out and finds unreturned library books, but he does it with a gun. it's brilliant. But this is really difficult to read online. I've been trying to find a copy of the mini comic, but it's a brilliant idea.
Cool.
So yeah, this is the Casita House project is going to be similar to that. Well, not actually similar to that, but it's going to have this nonsensical narrative that hopefully works.
How long have you been doing comics for in your career so far?
I think for a while now I've been saying 5 years, so it's probably not 5 years anymore. I think the first mini comic I did was 2002.
Right.
Which means I've now been doing it for 7 years.
And was that because you'd been going to conventions for a while and toying with the idea and you thought this time I'm going to bring something with me?
No.
Thank goodness for having an uncommon origin story.
Is that what everyone else does? I had no idea that anyone was making mini comics.
Okay.
I had no idea that there was that. I had a sort of road to Damascus moment. I always wrote and drew as a kid. Always loved comics, and I've always read comics. There's never been a time in my life when I haven't read comics. But I kind of gave up on the dream of being a comics creator. At the back of my mind, I always thought, well, I want to be a writer. But I half expected someone to knock on my door one day and say, oh wait, I heard you want to write Judge Dredd. And I go, oh yeah, brilliant. I've got this idea, come in. Yeah, apparently. although it's yet to happen. But you know, that didn't happen. And I moved to London. Actually, I'll tell you why I stopped drawing. I went to a club in Glasgow called SCAM, which I think stood for Scottish Cartoonists and Members, I think. They'd really struggled to get the acronym to work. And I went there, I was about 17, wasn't old enough to drink, and I was really nervous because I wasn't good at meeting new people. And I bumped into Mark Miller, who at the time was playing second fiddle to Grant Morrison. So Grant Morrison was in the middle. He was regaling the room with stories of writing GLA and all sorts of wonderful things. And I went to the bar and I was really nervous about getting served. I thought, are they going to serve me a pint of beer? And Mark Miller said, oh, do you want me to get this for you? I said, oh, that's very kind of you. He introduced himself. We sat down and chatted. And he gave me about an hour and a half of advice, which was fantastic. But it kind of boiled down to stop drawing. He said, if you want to write and draw, concentrate on one. And then come back. You know, he used Frank Miller as an example. He used himself and Grant Morrison as an example. And at the time he said, oh, we're gonna start drawing again at any point now. But I don't think they have. So I gave up drawing there, and I kind of gave up writing as well. I came to London, and I got a quite a well-paying job in London. Moved down here, bought lots of comics. Didn't have time to read them. Got fired from my job. Spent about 6 months on the couch. I was going out for bike rides, sitting in the sun, sitting on the couch, reading all the comics I'd bought, and it was just absolutely fantastic. I overloaded my senses with all these comics that I had no idea existed, and they'd been sitting in my, you know, in my living room gathering dust. And I had this road to the Damascus moment where I just put down a comic and I thought, well, I don't fancy watching a film, what will I do next? Because I was a man of leisure. And on my left was a pen and on my right was a pile of blank paper, and I just started writing a comic. Writing and drawing a comic on the page, and it was an autobiographical comic. And I don't know if you've seen Awkward Fascination, but it's the first comic there, and it just sort of flowed out. And after about an hour and a half, I had 5 pages, and it was a sort of mini autobiography. I thought, my God, that's fantastic! It was completely unconscious, and it just sort of poured out of me, and it was hugely cathartic. And I was really, really excited. And it was someone's birthday that night, in town. So I got the tube into town, and I went with this 5-page comic to the pub and showed it to everyone there, and I was so excited. And someone said to me, "Oh, it's the best autobiography I've ever read." And I don't think that's true, but I think it helps that it's only 5 pages long. but from that point on, I thought, right, well, I have to, you know, this is what I really want to do. I thought, well, no one wants to read this. And I thought, well, I don't care, because I want to do it. So I created, I did another sort of 15 pages of comics. They're a combination of jokes, a little bit of junior philosophy stuff. Got another job with a photocopier in the office, went in at midnight, photocopied a couple of hundred copies, went to Bristol. It's the first time I ever went to Bristol, but I went there just to drop copies of my comic off in the sort of reception area. Hung around, didn't know anyone, came back, and expected 2000 AD to knock on the door Monday morning and say, "Oh, I hear you want to write Judge Dredd." And I think I dropped off maybe 200 copies, and I got one email from a German guy who said, "Oh, these are really good, yeah." And that was it. That was me breaking into comics.
I see a common theme here, waiting for 2080 to knock on your door. However, you did recently write a Future Shock. Was that because you just kept on sending them story ideas and eventually they broke down?
Actually, what happened was I sent them lots of stuff. They refused it all. And I eventually paid Dan Lester to ghostwrite one for me, and it was accepted. So I'm owning up now. It was Dan Lester that wrote that story. No, I sort of pitched stuff on and off for a couple of years, or maybe longer than a couple of years. About 5 years ago, when I first went, well, kind of freelance, I sat down every week I'd try and write a Future Shock, and I don't know if you've ever tried, but a Future Shock is a 5-page.
Yeah.
Comic script. It's A4 pages, which means you can fit quite a lot on, and if you don't fit quite a lot on the page, it looks sparse. It looks like you're really not trying. So you have to.
Even if it is just a big idea, which
But
there has to be a setup.
There really has, because if you've got Future Shock with one idea, you read it, and it. Because I've read a bunch of Future Shocks now, because as soon as I had mine printed, the world sent me their Future Shock and said, "What do you think?" And I've read a bunch that were the way I used to try and write a Future Shock, which is one big idea. And you've kind of got 4 pages hinting at the big idea, and then the big idea. And that's, you know, that's not what they're looking for. They're looking for a different idea on every page. They're looking for some sort of narrative twist, a change of direction. It has to be interesting, it has to have a narrative drive. It has to and a very difficult thing to do is have proper characters in 5 pages. And I think that's the toughest thing, to have characterization, because a few things I've sent Tharg. He sent back and said, "Well, I like the idea, but you know, these are 2-dimensional characters." So I sent a bunch of stuff about 5 years ago. I think maybe 6 or 7 stories, and he only gave me feedback on the last one, and I thought, "Oh, I'm chasing up the wrong tree here." And then I bumped into someone at a comic convention who said, "Oh, 2000 AD is full for the next 5 years." I thought, "What? That's crazy!" And so I didn't. Much like the advice that Mark Miller gave me, although that was good advice. That was good advice, and he's a very nice man. So I kind of stopped. Then a few years later, Tharg emailed me.
We can use his real name. I interviewed him on the show and everything.
Okay. Dan Lester emailed me. No, Matt Smith emailed me and said, "We're doing this small press column, and I'm looking for someone to do a sort of diary of a creator." And Matt Badham suggested you for the job. Matt Badham had been writing a small press column for the magazine for, I think, about a year before that. So for about a year, I was writing this faux Grant Morrison-ish, Brass Eye-ish. The first one I wrote, I was so proud of it, because I decided I was going to create this champagne lifestyle for myself, make mini comics. The British indie scene sound like the life of Paris Hilton. And Matt Smith openly rejected it and said, "No, I appreciate that this is funny, but could you put some information in there?" So from that point on, I tried to, you know, I tried to make it vaguely educational. So I did that for about a year. Then the small press section closed up. And after that, I thought, well, you know, Matt at this point knows that I can write to a deadline. Because, you know, every month I think, right, I'd have it marked in my calendar, get column to Matt by the 15th. and he'd email me on the 12th and say, can I have it by the 15th? I go, oh! And then next month, I'd have it on the, marked on the 12th, make sure I email it to him by the 13th. And he'd email me on the 10th and say, can I have it on the 10th? And what I didn't realise was that the magazine slightly slips backwards in the month because I'm an idiot. Yes. So I never actually beat him to the deadline. But I thought, well, he knows that I can sit down and do work if need be. So I started pitching Future Shocks. And I think the one that got published was the second I'd pitched to him. Which isn't a bad, which isn't bad. The first one he rejected because, what was it? I really liked it. It was an Evel Knievel type character in a future world. So instead of doing fiery loop-de-loops, he was riding through black holes and gravitational things and stuff and blah. Aliens come down from space and say, well, we want to race Earth's greatest champion, and whoever wins, you know, if you guys win, you get our world, and if we win, we get your world. And it turns out that the Evel Knievel character is a sham. He can't even ride a bike, and the whole thing's been done by his special effects guy. But the twist is that the special effects guy wants a pay rise, so he's created this alien menace. And Tharg said, well, that was kind of obvious. I saw it coming in the first page. And I don't like stories where, you know,
there are no aliens in it.
Well, they're yeah. We get four pages of fantastic aliens and they're not real. So okay, well, and then I pitched the one that I got in at the end, which is The Lie, which is kind of an anti-creationist rant.
Well, I mean, I suppose 2000 AD and sci-fi at its best has always been somewhat satirical. And then 2000 AD, the Future Shock has been a real kind of crucible for British writers over the years. It's where Neil Gaiman, Alan Moore, Grant Morrison did some of their first, you know, early work.
I mean, did
you find the weight of all those writers kind of weighing on you when you were pitching those stories, or do you just think, well, it's just actually the way in for a lot of writers and everyone has to go through this?
I absolutely just saw it as a way in. Although that trivialises it. Because 2000 AD is pretty much the only comic I read on a weekly basis and have done since I was about 15. You know, my goal for a long time has been to be in 2000 AD. I mean, I wasn't joking when I said I expected Tharg to knock on the door and offer me Dread. It's been one of my dreams since a very early age. And to be part of that long, interesting history of the comic now, even though I've just had the one story published, is fantastic. And I think when it first happened, I was a little bit blasé about it, because the email came in late at night, because Tharg wrote back, and he wrote back and said, oh, some requested amendments, or no, can I ask for a change? I thought, oh god, it's going to be like, oh, can you change the entire plot? And he said, oh, on page 4, can you have the cops come out of a police van? I said, oh yeah, that's easy. That's two words. So I wrote back and said, yeah, absolutely. Here you go, here's the new script. And my girlfriend said to me, why aren't you jumping up and down with excitement? And I said, well, I think maybe I expected this to happen years ago. So I feel like
you've
I'm...
You've lived this moment in
yeah,
the dream,
yeah, in, so. Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of underwhelming that I'm only achieving it now. But when the comic came out, it was really exciting, because you know, it came through the letterbox. I read, you get three complimentary copies. I read all three. Yeah, three. That's the high life. Then I went into town. I read my story in a comic shop in town, and I just got back from the comic convention in New York. And the first thing I did in every comic shop in New York was find 2000 AD and read my credit. So that's
real.
Yeah, I said, oh, it's me in New York. So that's how sad I am.
Well, I mean, the comic industry in general seems to be something that interests you very much. I mean, I've bumped into you at various events, like the DFC launch at the NFT and various conventions here and there. And you've just been to the New York Comic Con. Is it the culture of comics as well as the comics themselves something that you're fascinated by?
The New York Comic Convention, it's the first time I've been in the States for about 3 years. Because I went for a couple of years, I thought, how do you work in America? You go to San Diego, you hand out your mini comics, you interest some editors, come back, someone knocks on your door and offers you X-Men. That didn't happen. Recurring theme. First of all, going this year with saying, you know, I've been published in 2000 AD, I got a hugely different response than, you know, 3 years ago when I went across with mini comics at Tongue of the Dead. They go, oh, 2000 AD. Except one publisher who said, 2000 AD, why haven't you worked since then? I was like, oh, let's just leave this. The convention itself, maybe it's because I'm going looking for work. I mean, it wasn't a holiday, it wasn't for fun.
Yeah.
You know, it was nice to hang out with people from Britain, but I was there to try and get work. And maybe because of that, it's not that I didn't enjoy the convention, but it was a job. It was a job, and I walked around for 3 days,
yeah,
targeting editors, and I came home with a massive blister in each foot. Hmm. So maybe if I was a bit more successful at this point in my career, maybe I would be more into the culture, or maybe if I had no aspirations, I'd be more into the culture. But as you know, as a guy looking for gigs, the culture is not what I enjoy. But by that, I don't mean I don't enjoy hanging out with other comics creators, because that is the best bit of comics.
It's the background noise right now.
It's the background noise right now.
I've obviously been going to comic conventions now for a couple of years as a open inverted commas journalist. And it is interesting how your relationship changes when you're no longer a fan, when you're actually going there for a reason. I mean, have you found it disheartening in a way, the comic conventions you've been going to in recent years, when you've been trying to get work, that you can no longer kind of enjoy it just as a sort of entertainment experience? Or is it now, because you're so motivated to get a job within the industry, it's just a different level of expectation, so you sort of treat both experiences in different ways?
Well, I don't know if I ever went to conventions as a fan. I think the first convention I went to was the one with 200 photocopied mini comics, right, in my rucksack, just because I thought of it as a way to get my name out there. And interestingly enough, years later that paid off. It turned out that, you know, all these guys had picked up the comic, and that's where they first saw my name, which meant that when I was standing in a bar at the convention, you know, feeling a bit lost, you know, being Billy No Mates, someone, you know, few people knew my name, and that's how I met people. Go, oh, I read your comic. So it wasn't a wasted time by any means. I don't think I ever went as just a fan, although when I did drop off those 200 copies, and when I say drop off, I mean I opened the bag, emptied them out, then went into the convention. I mean, I did. I went to the Marvel panel, I went to this panel, that panel, enjoyed them. Because I am, you know, I am a comics fan and I do read comics. Whereas I think it's been a gradual shift. But you go to these things and you're looking for your next mark. Although it's slightly different when I go to Bristol. When you go to Bristol, you have people there that you want to interview. I go to Bristol, I know there's no work there. there might be a couple of jobs going, but by the time I've heard about them, they've been filled, or I didn't want them in the first place, or sour grapes. So the British conventions are more about the socialising, but still not so much about the fan stuff. I don't think I've... I mean, I went to a few panels in New York and really enjoyed them. I went to DC, did a kids' comics panel. Jan Jones, the editor Jan Jones, talked about... they've got this a new Teen Titans comic, which is absolutely fantastic, and it's not hanging on a cartoon, it's not hanging on anything. It's drawn by a gal called Art Balthazar. It's absolutely fantastic. He draws these crazy... it's like one step up from stick figures. And he's done so... I've been a fan of his stuff for years, but now he's doing these Teeny Titans comics, and they're absolutely brilliant. So they were handing out copies of them, they were talking about the new Brave and the Bold cartoon. They're just talking about like getting kids to read comics, because obviously they're doing this bizarre thing where they're doing comics for kids, but they're only being distributed through the direct market. And you don't get kids going to comic shops. So they were saying, how do we fix that? And of course, no one had any answers, but the comics themselves were really cool. So that was exciting. Yeah.
As a comic artist rather than writer, although obviously you wear both hats simultaneously, you know, you do seem very adept at telling a story as a comic book artist. You've got a clean line, you know how to construct a page. But you've obviously got aspirations to write mainstream comics, but have you got aspirations to draw mainstream comics? Because it does seem increasingly that the mainstream publishers are very slowly becoming aware that maybe they should have different kinds of art within their pages, because there seems to be a school of Kirby-esque drawing, a school of this-esque drawing in mainstream comics, but then lately you have examples like Omega the Unknown, which, you know, is drawn very much in a small press style.
Yeah. No, in terms of immediate work, I would love to get some writing work. I haven't really thought about drawing for big publishers. And the other thing is, I can't draw other people's stuff. I can't draw from a script. I've done it a few times, and it's fine if it's a 3-page story or a 4-page story, but there comes a point when I'm not telling my story, and that becomes really frustrating. So I turn into a little prima donna. I don't tell the writer, but I turn into a little prima donna and think, oh my God, this is not the story I want to tell. So I definitely couldn't draw from someone else's script. At the moment, I'm happy to draw my own stuff and look for professional work as a writer. And I really enjoy doing illustration gigs. Non-comics illustration gigs. So stuff for magazines, stuff for websites. That's really fun. The Casita project, which I suppose in a way, because I'm doing all the artwork, and Dan's pretty much, you know, the ideas guy. And dealing with the client guy, which is fabulous. That's that's been a godsend, although God doesn't exist. So that's been kind of from a script, but that's been great because it's been very collaborative. But no, at the moment, my aspirations are just to enter mainstream comics as a writer.
And have the encounters you've had at these recent conventions, the feedback after your 2000 AD story, opened any job opportunities that seem that they have potential, or is it still you're going to be plugging away at it for a while yet?
I don't know. I chatted to loads of people, and I got business cards, which I'm led to believe is a good sign. So I have email addresses for lots of editors now, but that doesn't mean they're going to answer my emails when I send them. It's early days. It's early days. I'm talking to a few editors, or I was last week. I might not be now. By the time this goes out, I might have severed all links. I talked to well, there are a couple of guys, a couple of gigs that I really, really wanted to chase. I would love to do some X-Men stuff. Not particularly because I'm a massive X-Men fan, but I just think they're doing some really interesting, exciting stuff at the moment, and they're looking for guys to come in and do 5-page stories, 10-page stories, and I think that would just be absolutely fantastic. And Marvel in particular seemed to have a very fast turnaround on, you know, a new guy comes in, a new guy gets a couple of page, you know, a 5-page story or a 10-page story, and either new guy gets chucked out the door or a new guy starts pitching. So that seems like a really interesting dynamic. So I thought that would be a really cool thing to do. And we'll see.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
For more info about David's work, please visit my blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com, where you'll find links to examples of his comics online and my previous podcast with David's collaborator, Daniel Merlin Goodbury. On the next episode, I'm talking to Philip Spence and Richie Chandler about their mini comics, and that's on at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.